John Fulce, welcoming you to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio. From the swamps and bayous of South Louisiana, thanks for joining us in our little piece of culinary heaven where good cooking is just a way of life. Mornings begin here with a roux simmering in a cast iron pot, and our evenings end with thoughts of what we're going to cook tomorrow. All right, everybody, welcome to the kitchen table today. It's so nice to have all of you with us. It's absolutely wonderful, in fact, to have all of you with us. I picked up a melon this morning, Michelle. That big yellow strip across the bottom, that little tail end of the melon dried and curled, insinuating to the buyer that the melon is ripe and sweet. And I have it right now in the refrigerator.
Chilling her down.
And if you and Shirley.
Yes.
And, of course, our engineer over there, a good. Mm-hmm. I might let y'all taste my melon. Hey, y'all. Y'all can join me for the melon, I guarantee. Hey, it's so nice to have everybody with us today. I begin by saying hello to our executive producer, Michelle York. How are you doing?
I am good. And let me be the first to extend a happy birthday greeting to you.
Well, thank you so very much.
That's true.
Absolutely.
We won't ask your age. We'll just say that you're having another great
one. I am much older than I look. And wiser, I should say. And then Shirley Sands over here, our historian and archivist. How are you doing, Shirley?
I'm doing great.
Don't forget to give those figs to your mom.
I won't. She's going to love them.
I love this time of year, y'all. It's melon season. It's fig season. It's all kind of season. And I can't help myself. I made figs yesterday because I had a bunch of them on the tree. Figs everywhere. And then, of course, well, I should say the McLaughlin guys over there, but I only have one. Where's your dad today?
Houston.
What's he do? Oh, babysitting.
Seeing the babies, yeah. It's baby season, so he's going to go see the babies, and then they'll probably drive across to Georgia and see the other grandbabies.
How's your boy doing?
He's great. He's getting around pretty quick, very quickly.
Getting into his cooking and eating, huh?
Yeah, he's eating everything. In fact, you know, talking about garlic, whenever I cook, I use the right amount of it, which is a lot.
Yeah, all right.
And when I'll saute it up, and my wife ends up with several chunks on her plate that she never eats. And she used to always give them to me because I would eat them. But now she puts them up between me and the baby because he'll take a whole clove and
that's
pop
my
that
man.
In his mouth.
That's my man, right?
Loves it.
Oh, y'all. As I say, this is my favorite time of year. Once you get into the middle seasons between April, May, June, July, August, September, that's my favorite season besides Christmas in the first of the year. The gardens are just going crazy right now, and as you just said, one of our favorite ingredients in Louisiana cooking is not necessarily what many people call a part of the Trinity, which is our onion, celery, bell pepper. They normally leave garlic out and call it the Pope because of the shape of the pod, the hat of the Pope. So they call it the Trinity and the Pope. I put garlic in the Trinity, even above bell peppers. I say onion, celery, garlic, and then because a lot of people throw bell peppers in at the end. It's a subtle vegetable, right?
Yeah.
But it is part of the Trinity. Anyway, absolutely one of my favorite ingredients. What about y'all? You like garlic?
I love
garlic, yeah.
I don't think we can cook without garlic.
And I think that a lot of people who will say, I don't like garlic, they haven't tasted it the right way. Or when someone's cooked with it, they've either put in so much or maybe the wrong kind of garlic for a recipe. I learned that a lot, that there's just different kinds of flavors and different kinds of tastes. And sometimes the wrong thing gets used.
A lot of people will eat garlic raw. I'll bite on garlic raw when I'm cooking.
I don't believe I've ever eaten raw garlic.
Garlic originally was eaten raw, but by cooking it, of course, magical things
happen. Well, there's nothing like the smell of garlic that just permeates the air and lets everybody know you're cooking.
I was making a roux at my house one Sunday morning, and I set off the fire alarm. The fire alarm was right under my hood thing, because I mean right under my above my stove, because I don't have a hood, because my ceilings are like 15 feet up. Mm-hmm. So I say, well, I don't need a hood. A hood's distracting. I don't like a hood anyway. And I like the flavor of cooking. I like the smells and the aromas, right? Well, on this particular day, I was stirring a roux, and I wanted the perfect dark brown roux. So it started to smoke a little bit. And I didn't realize it until I saw the fire trucks coming into the driveway. But meanwhile, I had put in my onion, celery, bell pepper, and garlic into my roux. And the firemen started running up, and I said, what's going on? I said, well, it might be a fireman's parade. But, you know, I'm thinking, what could it possibly be? I didn't realize they were coming to save me, right? So I opened the back door and said, hey, guy, and he said, do you have a chef? Do you have a fire? And I said, no, I don't have a fire. And the fireman stuck his head in. Everybody stopped, and he said, oh, you're cooking a roux. Anyway, y'all, garlic is, without a doubt, I'm going to say the favorite ingredient when it comes to specialty ingredients in the pot of the Cajun Creole is that lovely stinking rose. Mm-hmm. That stinky rose, they call it. The exact place of origin of the garlic, I don't know. It's unknown. Most experts say that it originated in Central Asia somewhere, maybe. I remember hearing things like places I had never heard before, like Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, and that's where garlic came from.
That's right.
I didn't care where it came from. It came from papaya's garden. We know it was found growing wild in Siberia on the slopes of the Ural Mountains. It moved with nomadic tribes and with armies as they moved through Asia and Europe. Garlic went with them. And in history and folklore, garlic has really an unbelievably mixed reputation, right? I mean, in literature, in the Bible. Yeah. It has been valued, of course, for its medicinal properties since ancient times. It's been a fundamental part of Asian and Mediterranean cuisine. And it's also had, believe it or not, its negative association. The ancient Egyptians considered garlic sacred and used it in oath-taking as part of burial rituals as well. So when they took office, they swore on a garlic pot. We ought to do that here in Washington, I should say. Four varieties of perfectly preserved garlic bulbs were found, believe it or not, in the tomb of King Tut. Mm-hmm. Everything was found in King Tut's tomb.
Mm-hmm. He was well armed for the afterlife, yeah. Wasn't he?
Now imagine, why would he put four dried garlic pods in his tomb? I don't know, except that maybe it was a bargaining gift for the gods at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. We know that that dated back 2,000 years B.C. The Egyptian Book of the Dead includes 22 remedies using garlic. Mm-hmm. When the Israelites were guided out of Egypt by Moses and they started to remember some of the foods that they ate while they were in bondage, when they got into the desert and they started to fuss with Moses, of course, we'll remember when he came down from the mountains with the tablets and he threw them down and broke them because the Israelites had melted gold and built a golden calf to start to worship. Well, it was at that time that the leader of the Israelites said, "We remember the fish we ate in Egypt at no cost, also the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and we left Egypt without even taking our garlic." It was the food of the working class, the poor. Garlic was associated with laborers and warriors, as I mentioned, and peasants. Garlic was fed to the early Olympians in Greece, so they ate a lot of garlic. The Greeks, they must have smelled pretty funny. Yellow garlic helped Ulysses escape from being changed by Circe into a pig. Remember that story?
Oh, yeah.
I remember that. We learned that in Miss Aeneid's class.
In Miss Aeneid.
Miss Aeneid was big on Ulysses. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was in second grade, so it tells you what we were learning in St. James High School. We were learning things early over there. Yet for all of its medicinal and sacred value, garlic that we love so much to cook with has not always been used or appreciated by all cooks during all ages, especially those from English heritage. Garlics. Lucy Emerson wrote in her book New England Cookery in 1808, though used by the French, is much better adapted to medicine than to cooking these garlics. Mm-hmm. As she said.
I think she may have been mistaken.
She didn't have a great opinion of garlic as an ingredient. She joined Hippocrates and Pliny the Elder. You know, I have a plaque on my fireplaces at White Oak with Pliny the Elder, a quote from him.
You sure do.
How about the pig?
Yep.
So even Eleanor Roosevelt recognized the medicinal value of garlic. Anyway, y'all, it was Marco Polo that many people say found the Chinese cultivating and preserving raw garlic, and they were eating garlic-based sauces. In the early 1700s, a plague spread through France, killing thousands, and gangs of grave robbers grew rich by raiding the graveyards and removing clothes and jewelry and money from corpses. The thieves themselves managed, Michelle, to remain in perfect health and seemed immune from any illness when digging up those graves and corpses from the plague. And when captured, they admitted that they were gorging themselves with garlic and wine. And even today, there's a healthy salad dressing on the market called vinegar of the grave robbers. And now today, of course, we know that there's a lot of great medicinal value associated with garlic. Of course, it's used in classic soups and roast meats and fine sauces and pastas, and even referred to as the truffle of Provence. And when roasted, imagine a big clove of garlic wrapped in foil, a little olive oil and salt, put onto a barbecue grill this time of year or in an oven and allowed to soften in that foil with olive oil. It becomes sweet. It becomes a spread that's absolutely magnificent over hot bread. So many restaurants today are roasting garlic with olive oil and salt and herbs and spreading it across bread and bringing it to the table and selling it to you, Michelle, for about $5 a loaf just because there's roasted garlic.
Makes sense. Worth every penny.
Y'all, I remember Daddy would get those big bundles of garlic out of the garden, and I remember a great story I'm going to share with you after a while. Even my grandfather on his deathbed was thinking about garlic. We'll be back in a minute.
On Bill Street Caravan, we have got Alan Toussaint at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival. And then we're going to hop on the legendary Rhythm and Blues Cruise and hear from Tab Benoit. That plus our feature host, Preston Lauterbach, continues his feature host series, The Chitlin Circuit and the Road to Rock and Roll. That's all coming up on Bill Street Caravan.
Tonight at 11 on KRVS.
Host Megan Brown for Encore. Join me as we journey through the continuing timeline of our culture. We'll discover the music, relive festivals, and get to know the people. Sunday afternoons at 3 here on KRVS.
From the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, this is KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, now broadcasting in HD radio technology.
She put garlic in her salads and never had the flu. So she put it in her scrambled eggs and in her peanut butter, too. My mouth felt like a furnace when dinner time was through. But it helped in avoiding vampires and plague. She looked daily in the mirror to see how much she'd grown. She rubbed my feet and told me jokes, and I never felt alone. Everything we had was free. She liked it best that way. And we ate a clove of garlic every day.
everybody. Welcome back to the Garlic Show on Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio. And Michelle, I was mentioning right before we went to break, I remember I could see vividly Daddy's grape garden in January and February with those growing green stems of garlic. And then, of course, the ritual of picking it, laying it out in the sun of the early spring and drying it out. And then him teaching us to plait it at 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, plaiting those big strands of garlic. I'll tell you, great memories of garlic. And in addition to the crawfish etouffee and gumbo and jambalaya flavors it gave, you know what I mean? Anyway, y'all, hey, welcome to the Garlic Show. As I mentioned, I'm Chef John Falls, your host, and we're sitting around the kitchen table here talking about the stinky rose, one of my favorite ingredients in the trinity of Louisiana flavor. Michelle, we have a great guest to join us today.
Indeed we do. From Rose, New York, we have David Stern with us. David is a founding director of the Garlic Seed Foundation that was established in 1985. The foundation acts as a clearinghouse for information and research, all data on what else?
Oh, garlic.
All the information needed for cooks, gardeners, and commercial producers. David is a farmer, and we are delighted to have him with us on Stirring It Up.
And we love farmers, too.
So. Yes, indeed. David, welcome to Stirring It Up.
Good to talk to you.
Hey, thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate you spending a little time with us on Stirring It Up.
We're a couple of weeks from our harvest up here, but we're getting some good dry down weather, and we're looking forward to a good harvest.
You know, David, in the eyes of the American public, farming really seems to be in vogue right now. Just like celebrity chefs, everybody wants to be a celebrity chef, and I dare say many, many people want to be farmers. They want to get back to the earth. Did you come from a family of great farmers, or are you first generation?
I came from a military family and ended up going the educational system and came out and ended up in West Virginia working in the coal mines and started gardening and things in my early 20s. I turned to New York State, and with my parents getting sick, I had to come back and take care of my parents. And although many people don't realize it, New York State is a great, great farming state. It has a long history of agriculture, and I ended up settling here on the coast of one of the Great Lakes, Lake Ontario, on the Canadian border. And I've been farming here for 40 years.
Oh, my goodness. How many acres do you actually farm?
My farm is 60 acres. I farmed as many as 600 acres. But the time comes when you realize that in this game, particularly in growing food for humans, that you got to get smaller, you got to get smarter. I put down the chemicals in 1979 and started organic agriculture and been growing food for humans since.
And what all are you growing? You said that the harvest is near.
Well, I think this year we're someplace a little over 40 crops.
Wow.
We've finished rhubarb. We finished asparagus. We're finishing peas. Our first spinach is over, lettuce, lots and lots of collard greens. We grow lacinato kale, we grow lots of chard, fava beans. We tend to grow some of the less available crops. We've tried to make a niche for ourselves in growing what other people don't grow. 15, 20 tons of winter squash every year.
David, where's your market? Are you selling to vendors? Are you selling to truck farmers?
Well, we belong to a co-op of truck farmers, and probably 85, 90% of our crop goes to New York City. We're about 5.5 hours out of the city. Of course, when you have 16 million mouths to feed, it's a pretty good market.
Right.
Most of my neighbors have gardens. You know, we are a very, very rural area up here. We're in apple country. I mean, the crew is at a local farmer's market today, but most of our food goes down to New York.
The show today is about garlic because certainly it has a long, long, long history dating back to the beginning of recorded time, certainly. And here we are in Louisiana being cooks constantly seeking out more and greater flavor in everything that we cook. And we have four great growing seasons here, which is wonderful for small farming or gardening. And garlic is something that have always been a part of our gardens. But I know that traditionally garlic is pretty labor intensive. You know, once you get it into the ground in Louisiana, we put it in the ground around Thanksgiving, right before Christmas, and we tend it. But then that right after the holidays, the only thing sticking its head out of our gardens is the garlic. How do you approach your garlic, and what volume of your growth and sales come from garlic?
When we started the Garlic Seed Foundation in 1985, the United States was eating about 0.5 pound of garlic per person per year. And I wish I could take personal credit, but maybe you and I together could take credit for the fact that now we're about 3 pounds per person.
Oh, that's
wow.
Fantastic. Wow, I love hearing that number.
The Garlic Seed Foundation started because at the time in the early 80s, 10,000 farms, one quarter of the farms in New York State went out of business. It was the the Ronald Reagan eras, it was Earl Butts, it was the bigger farms were taking over a larger percentage, and most of the smaller farms were getting squeezed out. And we were very lucky to have a fellow at Cornell University with their land-grant agricultural school here in New York. And he and a bunch of us smaller farmers started looking at oriental vegetables and sweet potatoes and rhubarb, things, the minor crops they're called. Things that small farms could make an investment in, hit a niche in the market. And the one big one we hit was garlic. And garlic really took off by the hundreds and thousands of people that are gardening small plots. It is labor intensive, so we don't see large amounts of land. In New York State, John, I would say maybe the largest garlic farm would be 10 or 15 acres. Now, you know, if you're looking at 2 tons an acre, you're looking at quite a bit of garlic and quite a bit of money and an awful lot of labor. We don't have labor available up here. Garlic was moved out of Louisiana. It's a great story. Moved out of Louisiana into Texas in the 30s and went out to California and stayed in California so many years because they had cheap Mexican labor.
Right, right.
China today outproduces this country probably 100-fold. We went to China, saw how they grew the orange, and we stole it and brought it back to this country. The Chinese agriculturalists came into the Central Valley of California, saw how we grew garlic, took it back to China, and they are growing hundreds of millions of metric tons a year and have literally taken over the world market.
David, I'm in the food manufacturing business as well as the restaurant business and the catering business, and I'm just starting to see more and more groups, more companies coming to us from all over, not only the U.S., but all over the globe, trying to sell us garlic because we use so much of it. And it dawned on me that there must be a lot of production of garlic going on globally, South America possibly, certainly Asia, because I'm seeing so much of it come in. And now that you just answered that question, that they're growing so much of it overseas.
Yeah, China's a big one. Thailand rates very, very high, again, for labor purposes. Spain is the producer in Europe. Excellent, wonderful garlic grown in Spain. Garlic, the Allium sativum, the plant itself, comes from the Ural Mountains. It comes from the border of Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the Soviet Union. And it was there when Glasnost happened back under Gorbachev, and good friends of mine ran. The borders were opened. Scientists were allowed into the Soviet Union, and they ran into the Ural Mountains, and they really found the mother lode of original garlic. And it was kind of the first time that people had access to this. It is no coincidence that this is the trade routes of Marco Polo. That's how garlic spread. That was in these bazaars, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, you know, everything you hear in the news today. This is all the birthplace of garlic, and these strong, powerful, powerful vegetables spread very quickly. This was medicinal stuff back then. You know, what food could you eat that could make you cry, could make you tear, could do this to your mouth and your throat and the stomach? Early medicine men, early medicine women, they grabbed onto this plant very, very quickly, and it spread very quickly and, you know, continued.
You know, down here we grow Italian and Creole garlic. It does very, very well. What kind of garlic do you grow up in the Northeast?
Well, in 2003, a very important event happened in the world of garlic, and that is the United States Department of Agriculture gave some friends of ours in Colorado money to explore the genome. Mm-hmm. There are several collections of garlics in the United States. The big one is out in Walla Walla, Washington, owned by the USDA. We have one here. There's another one out in Pellier, California. Fillory Farm, a big farm up in Okanagan, Washington, has one. We all submitted every sample of our garlic, and the DNA was run. And we now know in the populations of the garlic in this country and the world, there are 10 cultivars of garlic. I don't know if we're going to call them cultivars or varieties, but we know that we have two of the non-bolting. These are Allium sativum, subspecies sativum, and we have Allium sativum ophioscarodon. Ophioscarodon is the ophio is a snake, and the snake is the bolting or the seed-producing garlic that we grow in the north. Pretty much of a split. We grow the northern Ophio garlics up here, and in the south, you're going to grow the silver skin, Creole, soft neck garlic.
One of the interesting things I found that garlic, much of it doesn't seed. You have to plant the garlic itself.
Great genetic question. How garlic lost its sexuality? Garlic in the Ural Mountains still produces a true seed.
Okay.
There's only two plants we eat that have lost their sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
Banana and garlic. Both vegetatively reproduce.
Times of the year also, David, my grandfather and great-grandfather and father as well were all farmers. We came from a farm community, and home gardening was really big and is really big in Cajun and Creole country, and it wasn't uncommon. Most homes have an acre garden because there was a lot of land in these rural areas where we grew up. And seasons of the year were often interpreted by the delivery from the seed companies of the little garlic plants coming in or the onion plants coming in. And it was a time of excitement for us because you'd go to the post office or the postmaster and come over and say, hey, look, your garlic just came in or your chicks just came in. So, I mean, it was a very interesting time growing up in a farm community for the excitement to be the seasons of our year in growing, you know.
I've heard many stories of people that their garlic that they're growing came over in a knapsack. It came over in a handkerchief from Europe.
Oh, wow.
It was brought by immigrants, and they culture that garlic, and they hold that garlic as dear as gold to them, and it's been cultivated in, you know, in this country for seven or eight generations since it was brought here.
Which I guess is why we have 500 or so different names of different kinds of garlic, but the reality is they all come, there's really 10.
Yeah.
Right, so families name it after their great-grandma or wherever it came from. And
that's right.
Go ahead, David.
Well, I was just going to say that there's great confusion in the naming of garlic. We know there's 10 varieties, but if you look in catalogs, you know, you'll see 200. Garlic was usually named after a physical trait, a red skin garlic, German red, or where it came from, Yugoslavia or something, and also the name of the farmer. We grow a lot of music up here named after a good friend of ours, Al Music, Canadian garlic farmer. But the flavors, you know, when you talk about flavors, one of the things that is really funny is of all the alliums, and in the genus Allium, there's about 400 in North America. And there's a lot of woodland plants. I'm, of course, not familiar with Louisiana, but when I lived in Appalachia and West Virginia, we had a lot of woodland alliums. They always called them wild garlic, wild.
Right, right.
Well, they're certainly not, but they're alliums, and all the alliums have the capacity to bind sulfur. Roots are attracted to sulfur, and when you look at a chart of things like you put all the vegetables on a chart, number one, of course, is garlic, and it's got a line 4 inches long. The next one's onion, and it's got a line 1 inch long. And then things like broccoli and brassicas come in. But up here, we're pretty much blessed with high sulfur soil, so our garlic tends to be more pungent, and the higher the sulfur content, the higher the medicinal value. A great experience of this, of course, is you're familiar with Vidalia, Georgia, Vidalia County, Georgia.
Sure, sure.
The Vidalia onion is Gran X 33. Gran X 33 is produced, was bred at Cornell University. If I grow a Gran X 33, it will burn my face. Mm-hmm. When they grow it in the sulfurless soils in Vidalia County, Georgia, it is as sweet as apple. The pungent qualities, the flavor qualities come from soil. Also from variety, but mainly soil.
Cool.
Now, what about planting garlic in your home garden? You are so passionate about garlic, I want to go plant some right now. Help me out here, because I am not a gardener.
Well, we always recommend trying to get something close to home. Let's say if I would sell garlic to a seed company and you would purchase that, well, that garlic's going to travel 2,000 miles from my place to your garden. Probably not going to do very well. So we always recommend people to seek out farmers markets or some places that you can find locally produced garlic that is, you know, what you buy is what you're going to be able to grow, and it's acclimated to your area. Mm. We found that whenever you bring garlic in from the outside, it always is going to take a couple of years for that plant to get used to your garden, get used to your soils. And in some cases, some of the garlic that I'm going to grow, like the porcelains or the rocamboles, probably are not going to do very good for you. And the Creole and the silver skins and those garlics from the southern areas certainly don't do very well for me. We grow them on a regular basis to keep the gene material here and to share, but it just doesn't do as well for production purposes.
Interesting.
Stay close to home if you can. If not, and I know you can get to Texas. I know on the internet there's lots of availability of seed, but try to get it close to home.
That sounds like a great idea. In your newsletter, The Garlic Press, you include recipes. I know you're laughing. So tell me, favorite recipes using garlic?
Personal recipe?
Yeah.
Your best.
Well, I've been known to have pasta with fresh garlic and Parmesan cheese for breakfast.
That's my man right there. Michelle, that is my man. I need to be with him.
But we actually, after 25 years of publishing our newsletter, we are on the verge of putting together the Farmer's Cookbook. And last winter when I had some time, we started collecting these recipes and going through them. And one of the great joys of working with the Garlic Seed Foundation has been working with farmers, and garlic farmers are a passionate lot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're intense about their food. We recently lost a member over in Ohio, and they sent me the obituary, and in his obituary it mentions that he is a garlic farmer.
Wow.
It's not uncommon that we see this, that people love this crop. They're very passionate, as you are, is cooking with it and eating it. We as farmers, it's just a little special than growing other vegetables.
David, let me know if you need a guest recipe in your book. I'll be happy to send you. I love cooking with garlic, and I'll be happy to submit a couple of them to you in garlic. One last thing I wanted to tell you, mentioned Russia in that area. I actually opened the first foreign restaurant in the Soviet Union prior to the fall. I accompanied President Reagan and Gorbachev to the summit of 1988. I opened an American restaurant at the Kremlin during that time when all the world press got there when Glasnost was first mentioned. And one of my favorite things that happened there was becoming acquainted with the Russian use of garlic with the cooks, with the cooks in the kitchen at the World Trade Center in Moscow. And I did. But
let me tell you that we have as much as we like garlic, when we look at the world consumption of garlic, and of course, Italy is always talked about. Italy's about 8 pounds per person. And really, when you get to Germany, you talk about 12 to 14 pounds per person. But if we were serious about garlic, we could look at Thailand at 40 pounds per person per year. Korea is 60 pounds per person.
Isn't that amazing? Well, David, thank you so much for being, my God, what a great guest you've been, and just so wonderful to inspire. As Michelle said, you've inspired her to go grow garlic somewhere. So we're going to let you go. We thank you so much, and we appreciate it. We'll put all of your information, including the newsletter, on our website, jfalls.com. If everybody goes to jfalls.com or to our Facebook page, Michelle, right there.
Facebook.com/Stirn It Up Radio.
We're going to have David's information as well as his newsletter. And David, thanks so much for being with us today from New York.
Thank you.
Happy
you
holiday
too.
Of see you. We love garlic, and we could not have chosen a better guy. When we come back, we're going to talk more about it and cook with it.
Spices and vegetables that you can grow. Some are under the ground, some grow tall. Though they all have their qualities, this you must know, that the garlic is best of them all. The Egyptians, Phoenicians, the Vikings, the Greeks, Babylonians, Danes, and Chinese on their voyages took enough garlic for weeks, and their enemies died on the breeze. Since biblical times, in all parts of the earth, it has cured countless sufferings and ills. Oh, if we understood what the garlic is worth, we would throw out our poisonous pills. In Bulgaria's mountains and Russia's white plains, people live to...
Greetings, I'm Jake Hebert.
And I'm Adam Chouard. Join us every Friday at midnight for the Sound Club radio program.
Your home for left field pop gems from today to yesteryear.
Here on 88.7 FM KRVS.
Looking for a youthful perspective on classical music?
Well, I'm going to play the Liszt Transcendental Etude No. 7. It's very exciting and energetic, and there's hard-hitting parts and soft parts, and overall, it's a pretty good piece.
Look no further than From the Top. Join me, Christopher O'Reilly, for our 10th anniversary season, each week right here on NPR.
Tuesday night at 7 on KRVS.
Soy Fernando Pérez Villar. Únanse a mi programa Espacio Latino este domingo a las 5 p.m. para que escuche buena música latina e información sobre la cultura latina aquí en el sur de Luisiana.
That's Espacio Latino, coming up this Sunday evening at 5 here on KRVS.
Regional Public Radio for Acadiana. KRVS-FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
Garlic is in bloom, the moon is getting fuller, and it chill run through the hills, and something starts to quiver underneath your daffodils. The earth may start to tremble, you hear a real, real sound, and in the morning when you wake, there's garlic all around. A rolling breeze brings on a smell that goes right down your veins. You jump right out of bed as you're relieved of all your pains. Outside the bees are buzzing, the birds sing loony tunes, all nature's going crazy when the garlic is in bloom.
All right, everybody, welcome back to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio. And what a great guest Shirley David was.
He was really interesting, wasn't he?
Yeah, very passionate about his work.
Exactly.
And you're going to let us know about his website.
It'll be there, because the foundation does have its website, so we'll have that on there.
Michelle, I mentioned earlier that my grandfather, Papaz Orang, who I reference often, grew up on Cabanossi Plantation and lived there all of his life, my mother's dad. The thing that I never forget about him, and it just sticks in my brain 50 years later, and that is that when he was in the hospital dying, we went to visit him as a bunch of children to go see Papaz, you know. And I'll never forget him saying, looking up from his bed, you know, my garlic's in the garden and we need to get it out.
Oh.
Would y'all help me get it out so when I get out of the hospital we can have it all dried out and I can plant my garlic? And we said, oh yeah. So our gift to Papaz was to go dig up his garden. He never got out of the hospital.
Oh, gosh.
And I'll never forget planting his garlic and putting it up. And I was maybe, I'm going to say I was probably 12 at the time or whatever. But I remember distinctly planting that garlic and putting it up on the nails in his barn, mm-hmm. thinking to myself, he's never going to see his garlic.
Yeah.
That's the thing I remembered most about his, and I remember it clear as yesterday today.
Sure.
So that's the impact that his garlic had.
That's
right. He was a great gardener. Papaz Orang, Albert Albaz Orang. Anyway, Michelle, you mentioned during the break about the medicinal. He mentioned the medicinal qualities of.
When we think about it, arthritis, asthma, toothaches, freckles, baldness, athlete's foot. The plague, cancer, cardiovascular disease, all of these are just a few of the maladies that people throughout history have treated with garlic. In 3000 BC, the father of Indian medicine described early uses of garlic to maintain the fluidity of blood and strengthen the heart.
Garlic always associated with blood.
It's true. Always. Mm-hmm. In Egypt, the Codex Ebers, which is one of the earliest Egyptian medical manuscripts, that's dated about 3500 BC, also includes garlic for the blood and the heart. Pliny the Elder in his work...
There he is again.
Pliny. He used garlic for 62 ailments, everything from dog bites to tumors.
That Pliny is something.
By the 1800s, Louis Pasteur reported that garlic killed bacteria. During World War II, garlic juice with water was actually used to disinfect wounds. And today, there are a large number of studies that have been done looking at garlic's value in treating cholesterol, triglycerides, high blood pressure, infection. Garlic truly is amazing. It's not just to cook with.
Well, you know, and we're reading, and I think David may have mentioned as well, that in some of these areas, Uzbekistan and all mm-hmm. of this, people
right.
live to be 115 years old. You
right.
see the oldest person on earth coming from these areas, the Ural Mountains, where mm-hmm. garlic is eaten by the pounds mm-hmm. and
that's
the pounds.
Right.
Maybe
and
that's the real fountain of youth, garlic pods.
I think so. Anyway, great health benefit. So I love cooking with garlic, and just to think that it's going to keep me alive to 115
makes it even better. It's an extra benefit.
Say, I'm going to add another 6 pods to each and every one. Michelle,
I want to remind everybody about Facebook again.
How many people? We got about 10 or 15 by now.
We have well over 100.
Oh, we've crossed 100 mark.
Yeah.
We're moving forward now on our Facebook page.
Facebook.com/stirringitupradio.
Who's writing to us on that? Are they cussing us out or are they praising us?
No, thankfully. We set up the filter to take out the... And boy, that filter is full. The idea for the garlic show is actually one of our listeners who went on the Facebook page, David Hubble, requested the garlic show.
Yeah, David's a great listener, great friend. David, how you doing? He's on the Gulf Coast.
He comments all the time. We also have questions from some of our listeners. And in fact, one said, Chef Foles, I can never get my gumbo roux darker than peanut butter. I love those dark liquid gumbos, but mine are always thick and light in color. Do I have to sit over it all day to get that color?
My problem is that I can't do a roux that's not dark as molasses, so I'm listening.
Well, the two of you have two different issues. the gentleman who wrote about the roux?
That's Eric Gaucher.
Okay, Eric. So I have to tell Eric that his problem is he's probably, I don't know, but he's probably putting the flour and the oil together in the pot, cold, turning the fire on, or getting his oil, vegetable oil, probably getting the oil to about 300 degrees or 250, putting the flour in and stirring it and stirring it and stirring it and gradually letting it get up. And then he kind of gets bored and tired with stirring it, and he can only get so much of a color. And you're doing the opposite. You're getting your oil so hot that when you throw your flour in, it immediately starts over brown quickly before you can stir it. So what I recommend to both of you, you bring your oil up to the smoke point. So you put your oil in the pot, 1 cup of oil to 1 cup of flour, which will thicken 3 quarts of liquid to a perfect soup consistency, right? You bring your oil and you watch that cast iron pot, and in one hand you have a cup of flour, the other hand you have a whisk. Forget the spoon for a minute, get a whisk. You watch the pot intently. You can use a digital thermometer if you want. You bring in your temperature up to 375 degrees. That's the smoke point of vegetable oil. So you watch when that first little whiff of smoke, not when it's smoking, that first little whiff that you're going to catch with the corner of your eye, you immediately dump your flour into that pot and you stir like crazy with your whisk, and you're going to see the steam shoot out of that flour. All of the water that is in that hydroscopic starch, that flour, will instantly evaporate, and now your flour will start to brown quickly because you cannot brown flour until the water is out of it. So you bring your temperature at oil to 375. You look for that first little smoke point. You dump your flour in all at once. Just dump the cup in there, and you stir with that whisk, and that whiff of steam will shoot out of the pot. Then your flour will start to brown instantly, and you just stir it until you get to the temperature or color you want. So Eric will be able to get his roux nice and dark very quickly. In 5-7 minutes, his flour will be as dark as he wants it to be, and he stops the cooking instantly once he achieves his color by adding his onion, celery, bell pepper to the pot quickly, and it'll drop the temperature from 385 to 400 degrees to about 320, and he doesn't have to worry about it scorching anymore. It'll be the perfect brown color. Is that what you're going to do, Michelle?
Yeah, I'm going to throw my vegetables in earlier because I think I'm cooking it too long.
You think you're cooking it too long?
I'm letting it get a little too hot. I'm waiting until it's smoking, not the first whiff.
No, the first little whiff. Don't let it smoke.
And then I think I'm cooking it too long. Well, not to scorching.
If it starts smoking too much, you're at 385 to 390, and you don't need it that hot. You need just enough, that first little whiff of smoke indicating 375, because that's going to evaporate the water out of your flour instantly. And think of it this way, y'all. If you take a slice of bread and you put it under a faucet and it's soaking wet, and then you put it in a toaster, how long is it going to take to brown?
Forever,
because it's a wet toast. Right. You wouldn't do it anyway, right? Well, that's what flour is. You're putting wet toast in your toaster. When you put flour in cold oil, it takes forever to get the water out of the flour. Whereas if you throw it into that smoke point, it's going to evaporate at 212, just like that, because water evaporates at 212.
Yeah. And as our students have learned, they've got to make sure they're not sitting right over top that pot, or they're going to get scalded with that steam that comes.
You pick out a good. You pick out one or two great questions a week for us, and we're gonna do our little Facebook segment. What you think, Michelle?
I think that's a great idea.
That'd be a good segment. Yeah. You can ask the question, and I'll answer it. That's like you coming to the Oracle at Delphi.
I do that all the time.
The cooking oracle right here. Shirley, what about books or literature or anything we should know on garlic?
Well, actually, I'm going to share with everybody. We're going to have it on our website. It's a connection to a PDF from the Herb Society of America. The Herb Society has a substantial guide, 50, almost 60 pages long, on garlic. History of it, cultivation, pests, diseases, pruning, how to preserve it, some recipes, all of it. It has a great section dealing with readings and references, so if you want to learn more about what they're talking about, you can go there. Anything you want to know. So we will have the link to the PDF on the Herb Society. Beautiful photographs so you can see what the different kinds of garlic look like. So we'll have that there. Plus, of course, the connection to the foundation. But I found this in doing some research. The Herb Society of America has some fabulous things, and their guide on garlic is
beautiful piece, too. I'm looking at it right now. It's really gorgeous. And then you can also put the newsletter, right?
That's right.
From David.
That's exactly right.
Okay, y'all, you went to the store, you've been there, you walked aisles, you picked up some garlic. Mm-hmm. Not the ones in the jar, Michelle. You can pick that up. I like the one in the jars, too. I like the whole clove, and I like the ones that's already chopped. I like convenience.
I have to warn everybody about something that happened to me. I was getting the whole cloves already peeled, you know, because I was in a hurry. And I got home, and they were from China.
Well, you heard what David said?
Yeah, I was shocked. I never looked for an origin because I couldn't imagine that we would be importing garlic into Louisiana.
Well, China is one of your largest
by far. So be sure you look.
How do you store it? How do you keep your garlic fresh? Well, it's best to keep it in one of those little mesh bags. You know the little bags that you buy onions in or something from the store? Or shallots, they have that mesh bag. Like I call it a little crawfish sack. A little one-gallon crawfish sack. Put it in that little mesh. Cardboard boxes are good. Baskets stay cool. Shady areas with good circulation because garlic can be stored outside of the refrigerator. Needless to say, you don't have to refrigerate it. Mm-hmm. Do not store your garlic bulbs in the refrigerator. They're going to get moldy that way. You know, I know a lot of people do, but I like to keep mine out. Now, if you have that green garlic that you're growing, you can store that in the refrigerator for about 2 weeks if you hadn't dried it yet, just in loose paper, but you might have your watermelon tasting a little garlicky. Garlic varieties have different intensities to a flavor, so when it comes to choosing the kind to cook with, it's really important that you understand the recipe, how you intend to use it. While different garlic cultivars have different levels of heat and flavor, the method of preparation normally will influence the flavor as well. I love whole or roasted garlic. Mm-hmm. I like to poach it in stews or fricassees. Cooking garlic makes it sweeter and milder, so roasting will produce a nice, complex, nutty flavor, caramelized flavor that you can mix with oil and salt and pepper and just spread it on French bread. And, of course, as Shirley said, you can go to she's going to put the Herb Society of America PDF on so you can get all of that. Michelle, two great recipes I'm putting on the website today. I'm putting my oven-baked garlicky crabs, and the reason I'm doing that is because, it's crab
season. These are hard shells?
Hard shells. I'm taking the top shell off. I'm taking the dead men or the little lungs out of it. I'm taking all the trash out. I'm taking the mouth off of the crab. I'm breaking them in half, and I'm putting them in the oven with olive oil that's been sauteed, that garlic has been sauteed in, a lot of garlic, 40, 50 cloves, a little fresh cracked black pepper, and a lot of roasted garlic, and I spread that over the crabs, stir them good, and throw them into the oven and bake them or roast them with that garlic cloves and garlic olive oil and pepper. Y'all, you've never had anything better than that. Of course, unless you're eating my garlic soup. Sopa de ajo, that great Spanish. By the way, the Spanish brought a lot of the garlic to Louisiana.
Sure did.
And the sopa de ajo, the garlic soup, is absolutely fabulous. I want you to take 16 cloves of garlic, thinly slice it, half a cup of extra virgin olive oil, and you're going to divide that with 12 2-inch cubes of French bread. So you have 16 cloves of garlic chopped. You're going to take the French bread, and you're going to put the olive oil in a cast iron pot, about a quarter cup in the pot. And you're going to take 6 of those French bread cubes, and you're going to season with a little paprika, a little salt, a little pepper, stuff like that. Then you're going to put in that olive oil. The garlic has been sauteed in. So you're going to take those 16 cloves of garlic and saute half of it in that olive oil to put that wonderful garlic flavor in the oil. Then you're going to put 6 of those French bread cubes that have paprika on them for color. You're putting a little reddish color into it. Then you're going to fry it in that olive oil just until it turns brown. Then you're going to take it out of the pot, add the other half of your olive oil into the pot. Do the same thing with the other 6 French bread croutons. Put a little paprika, salt, pepper. Put that into the pot that is now infused with the other 8 cloves of garlic that's been sauteed. But the important thing is that you're putting half of your olive oil, a quarter cup in the pot, and then you're putting half of the garlic and you're infusing that olive oil with the garlic. Then you're adding your French bread to suck up that olive oil that's full of garlic, right?
Gotcha.
And the bread has a little red paprika on it for color. And salt and pepper. Okay, once that's done, you put all of that into a Cuisinart, and you puree it into a paste. So you have your garlic-flavored bread, the garlic sauteed in there, the paprika. You cook that into a paste because you know what you just made?
What?
Your roux.
Oh.
You made a French bread garlic paprika roux, whether you like it or not. That's what you made. Into a pot, you're going to put 5 cups of a nice, rich chicken stock. You're going to add a half a cup of tomato sauce to it. Now you have that nice red color. You're going to put a bay leaf in it, and then you're going to dump that bread that's been infused with that magnificent pot roasted garlic that's sauteed in the oil, the olive oil has been sucked up by the bread. Then you're going to put that into that pot of 5 cups of chicken stock with that 1/2 cup of tomato sauce, and you're going to stir it around. You're going to break that pureed bread garlic mixture into the soup, into the stock, and it's going to thicken right away, right? Because after all, bread thickens.
Right.
That stock is fully flavored now with garlic and olive oil, right? By the way, I should tell you a secret.
What?
I double the garlic because I love the garlic more intense. You bring it to a rolling boil. You reduce it to simmer. Now the garlic and the bread is going to dissipate and cook in that chicken stock. That tomato sauce is going to be beautiful. The bay leaf is going to add flavor. And now you're ready to serve it. You're going to put your oven on 375. You're going to put 6 soup cups in the oven. You're going to crack 1 egg in each soup cup. You're going to ladle the hot soup on top of that egg. Mm-hmm. You're going to have an egg cracked in the soup cup. You're going to put the boiling hot soup on top of it. And you're going to let it sit for 7 to 9 minutes in the oven while that cup gets hot and that egg gets poached perfectly. The white is cooked. The yolk is raw. Not raw, but, you know, over easy. And then, Michelle, you serve that sopa de ajo with that poached egg. It's magnificent. Recipe on the website, y'all. Go eat garlic. The stinky rubber.